Welcome back to Punk News Podcast 362. Nothing big happening. Well, I'll say this is a medium level podcast. We got something to talk about. We got a big thing to talk about this week. I take it all back. Welcome to episode 362, the biggest podcast of the year. Not really, but kind of. This is Features Editor John Gentile, indecisive and scatterbrained as always, welcoming you back to the Punk News Podcast. First of all, we are here with news writer, reviews writer, news editor, interviewer, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, what's happening out there on the West Coast?
We'll get into the show that I went to last week, but I'm getting over being sick, and it's been a few episodes, so I'm glad to be back.
Well, welcome back, and we're also here with the main man. Managing editor Adam White up there in Canada, who I will be seeing in a mere 4 days or 3 days. 3 days.
Will we kiss?
Will, like Ross and Rachel, will they or won't they?
Yeah, I mean, I only ask because it'll really be the first time that we physically could kiss. So, the question bears asking.
Now, would it be a romantic kiss or would it be a fraternal kiss like the Italians do?
I was thinking one of those those mob kisses where it's sort of a condemnation of death.
You know, when I was in Egypt, the guys kiss each other on the cheek all the time. And this is true. I've probably kissed more men than I have women because in Egypt, every single guy you meet, they kiss you on the cheek. You know what I mean? So let me tell you, I kissed a lot of men in Egypt.
I will find out from you another time why you spent enough time in Egypt to kiss multiple people.
Oh, because I was excavating and it was a lot of fun. But we can talk about that on another podcast. But
all right, that's oddly fascinating. Can we can you explain this to the people? Because I think someone else is going to want to know this. You were excavating what, like the Sphinx?
Not the Sphinx. I was excavating in Tel Aruba, which is the ancient capital of Mendes, where Akhenaten was for a little while and some other pharaohs. It was during college, and I actually had a minor in Egyptology. And one of the bigger regrets I have is not going into Egyptology for grad school. The irony being that had I went right from college, I probably would have been a pretty crappy professor or maybe not even a grad student. But with the skills I gained in law school, I would have, I think, been able to blow all the other grad students out of the water, just the way you learn to think and process and collect information in law school. That's the irony. I studied under Dr. Donald Redford from Toronto, who is one of the five, and he's old now, he's like 90. He's one of the five superstars in Egyptology. Like he's a heavy hitter, super heavy hitter. And so every year, I don't know if he still does now, but for a long, long time, every year, he would go to Mendes, which was kind of his site, and students would come and excavate. And I went and I excavated and I hung out with Native Egyptians all day long and ate with Native Egyptians all day long and dug up some 5,000-year-old stuff and went to Alexandria, went to Cairo, or Kahara, as they say in Egypt. I went to El Mansour and had one of the greatest times of my life. And, went to the Egyptian Museum for 3 days straight, stayed there from opening to close. And Egypt was a wonderful country. Now it's a little bit more than it was when I was there, which is very unfortunate because the religious extremist people took over. Hopefully Egypt will get back to like it was, at least tourism and religious control-wise, as it was in the early 2000s.
So all this goes to explain why your record label has its name that it does.
Indeed it does. Shall I explain the meaning behind my record label? Because no one's ever asked me, and it's bothered me so much.
I'm asking you, John.
So I'm quite proud of this, and maybe it's a little too clever. And also, in a way, I kind of regret that I didn't pick an Italian guy, because I don't really have a connection to this. And I thought, well, but too late now. The record label is Narmer Records. Narmer is the pharaoh that united Upper and Lower Egypt. He was a total badass, and the reason he united Upper and Lower Egypt is because he stormed King Scorpion's, no, I'm sorry, Scorpion King, and grabbed him by the head and smashed his head open and beat out the Hyksos and the Akkadians. He beat them back out of Egypt. So he united Upper and Lower Egypt. And that's very important because that was the first, I guess you would say, very prosperous civilization during his rule and the subsequent dynasties. There was a gigantic progress in writing, mathematics, culture, science, all that stuff. It was a new era for the world because of King Narmer just defeating Scorpion King. And so I made that my logo just because I think he looks totally badass, and it kind of reminds me of the Misfits logo. And the catalog number is Nesubt, which is Egyptian for ruler of Upper and Lower Egypt. And the joke is that it's, you know, each tape is Nesubt1, Nesubt2, Nesubt3. And it's kind of a joke because pharaohs, like their wine or their grain, they would stamp it Nesubt, meaning upper ruler of Upper and Lower Egypt. So it would mean the best. Don't touch it. And so the joke is, you know, Nesubt3, I think that's the flames. That means the king's best, number three, you see. And so that's the name. That's where Narmer Records came from. And Adam, thank you for asking, because no one's ever asked me that. And it's driven me insane.
Well, actually, so I did that. It's weird that you mentioned the catalog numbers, because I was, and I don't know why I was thinking about this in the shower yesterday, but I was thinking about this in the shower, which was, I was... It occurred to me that, like, at some point in my life, I will pull the trigger on starting like a little 7-inch label. And what the catalog numbering is will be very important to me. And I have not put any thought into that. And it's bothering me that I don't have some like plan in my back pocket about like what the clever catalog numbering system of this label that doesn't exist is going to be. That's really the most important part. I mean, fuck the music, man. It's like catalog numbering.
It's like making a beer. It's like being a beer brewery. Like, most people, I think, start beer breweries not because they want to make a new great kind of beer, but they want to put a cool label on it. You know what I mean? It's kind of the same thing with record labels.
I mean, because there are just some that I remember from a kid always have the same sort of like look to them. So like the Epitaph catalog numbering was always like super familiar to me. And you know, you'd scan through a bunch of CDs and you would know which ones are the Epitaph ones, because they would all be like, well, like 8302 something, like they would all start with something like that. Let's see about this Epitaph.
The Alternative Tentacles is like Virus 141.
Yeah.
Virus,
yeah,
322.
Right?
Crass had a really unique one. Is they started from the back and went forward. So their first one was, I think, 4B4, 1984, then 3B4, 1984, then 2B4, 1984, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, so like basically everything that Epitaph released after 1988 was listed as like 86400 and then like plus one as you went, right? So, I mean, at this point, they're up to... They're in the 868s at this point, but you know, I remember I would look and, you know, you would see 864, 864, 864. Like that was everything. That was the Epitaph one. I don't even know if there's a meaning for it in particular, but it was just one of those things that got drilled into your head when you're just kind of like obsessing over the weird little details on something. It's same with like, I don't know if this ever mattered to you, but like, would you always go and look and see like what the name of the musician's publishing company was?
Yes. Yes.
Right. Because, so I guess I don't know why you even need to give them a name, but I guess like for people that don't know this. So like if you're a musician in the States, at least, and you're a member of either like ASCAP or BMI, your copyrights, I guess, are owned by a publishing company that's in your name. That's registered.
The copyright in your written, in the transcript of your music, not in the sound recordings.
Yeah. So, and everyone would just come up with these kind of sometimes goofy little publishing company names, and you could just be like free and wacky with them because no one really gave a shit what they were, and like they never came up in conversation. They would never be, you know, never be on a billboard somewhere, that, right? It was just like a completely private thing, but it needed to be written down. And a lot of the times bands would have like reference their own songs and things like that to quickly kind of come up with these names. So I remember that like a lot of the Rancid records were done to like, I want to know where the action is.
Right, right.
And it, depending on how they were splitting up the credits on things, I think, like, you could sometimes have more than one show up. Where, like, if it's not, like, the band's publishing company and, like, there's, like, things to individual songwriters, they would have different ones that show up in there. But, again, like, little details that you used to, like, dig through. Those were fun. I liked those. I don't know if they actually, if there's, like, some public accounting of them somewhere. I'd love to have a list.
Well, there is, like, ASCAP and BMI each have a list. And one of the reasons why there are so many wacky names, it's like the Actors Guild. Nobody can have the same name as somebody else, you know? Tegan and Sarah, naked in a snowsuit. Which I think is amusing.
Let's see. I want to know where the action is music. Oh, look. Discogs. Publisher for songs by the American punk band Rancid. Oh, there you go.
Well, speaking of American punk bands, Ricky recently saw Blood Clot. And when I saw Blood Clot, they were awesome when they were playing, but there was a lot of space in between the songs. And I thought the show could have – the actual music was awesome, but the show could have used a little bit of tightening with the space between the songs. Ricky, when you saw Blood Clot, how was it? And was Negative Approach there too?
So, yes, Negative Approach did play. Now, keep in mind, I was sick when I was there, so I only saw a couple songs of Negative Approach. And then left because I barely made it through Blood Clot and the other bands. But I don't know about you, but Nails headlined that.
Not a fan.
I didn't even stay for them. It just felt like the life was being sucked out of me. Blood Clot kicked ass. I mean, there's no, that album kicks ass, and they were, I mean, that, if that's not a super group, I mean, shit, what is? I mean, they were really, really good. I thought, because I think there were because there were a total of five bands that night, I think they needed to keep it pretty quick. But in terms of, like, banter in between songs, there wasn't a whole lot from what I remember. And whatever was said, I mean, it wasn't anything like anything new or like very profound from John Joseph. I mean, John Joseph did his usual, you know, his PMA, you know, he did an anti-Trump thing, quip briefly because Final Conflict kind of took care of that before them. He talked about PMA. He talked about, doing his, another Iron Man or something like that, but it wasn't anything spectacular or funny. I'd prefer funny banter in between songs than serious and kind of typical. But it was fine. I loved it. I thought I was so happy to hear Cali. I mean, the fact that John Joseph is able to sing and scream at his age like that is just fucking mind-blowing. I mean, that whole, he is so energetic up on stage. I actually liked it more than when I saw him with the Cro-Mags about a year or two ago. It was great. Whole thing was great.
Well, there you have it. Ricky Franco giving it 2.5 thumbs up. Let's reach into our mailbag. As always, you can reach that at podcast@punknews.org. This is Liverpool Neil. He writes in to tell us what a bad job we're doing. And he takes me to task on two things, but I got to disagree with him. Or three things he takes me to task, but I got to disagree with two. So here's what Liverpool Neil has to say. Hello, chaps. Liverpool Neil here. Just a couple of comments about episode 359. By the way, Stanford Sean is really coming to his own and doing a great job. First, John. Billy Idol was never a roadie for the Sex Pistols. Never. He was in the Brahmin contingent along with Susie Sue and Steve Severin, who were early followers of the Sex Pistols, but he was never a roadie for them. Shortly after seeing them, he started his band Chelsea with Gene October, where he played guitar, and then left to form Generation X as the singer. The rest is history, as they say. I gotta disagree. Well, first of all, I note that Liverpool Neil neglects to mention that Sue Catwoman was also in the Bromley contingent. But also, I think Neil's nitpicking a little bit. I mean, what's the definition of roadie? Billy Idol helped the Sex Pistols carry their amps and set up and that kind of a thing. To me, that's a roadie. You know what I mean? I guess he didn't tour with them, but if you're helping set up amps and stuff, that's a roadie. I don't know. Second, I love, and I agree with Neil's point on this one. Second, I love the show, but something in the episode made me scratch my head, and I'm surprised I haven't noticed it before. I'm talking about when you were talking about a song you were premiering, I Hope Your Band Goes Nowhere by Talay. You discuss it in length for 5 minutes and made it sound so interesting that I was waiting to hear it when you were done. It was the perfect introduction, but then you simply went on to talk about something else. Why on earth didn't you play the song that you all had just been talking about? That makes no sense and really destroyed the flow. I'll give Neil points for that one. We probably should have played that song. I think the song was good. I think I just had a song I wanted to play instead, but we probably should have played that song. I don't know if you guys have any comments on that.
I mean, when we premiere stuff and we talk about it on here, I think, first of all, we don't talk about premieres too often on here. But a lot of the time, you know, when we're premiering something, it's out way. I mean, we get the premiere like weeks before the full album comes out, and we're actually able to get the MP3 version on our computers and able to edit into this podcast. So we can't just. And also, there's a lot of like, you know, we have to be in contact with the label. So I don't know if that's an issue because it's not out yet. But that's the reason why I tend to not play stuff we premiere on here.
Well, that tricky opinion. I think we probably should have played it, but you know, I'll give Neil that point. But I resoundingly disagree with Neil's third point. Third, and another one for John. Rebel Yell. No, John, the phrase didn't come from a brand of whiskey. It was a battle cry of the Confederate soldiers in the Civil War. They used the yell during charges to intimidate the enemy and boost their own morale. Interestingly enough, there are no known recordings of the Rebel Yell, so nobody really knows what it sounded like. Anyway, enough for now. Stay free from Liverpool, Neil. I resoundingly disagree with Liverpool Neil, and I will cite my sources. Yes, Rebel Yell was something Confederate soldiers would do, but the song Rebel Yell came from when Keith Richards gave Billy Idol a bottle of whiskey of the whiskey brand Rebel Yell, and Billy Idol said to Keith Richards, can I write a song off this? And Keith Richards says he didn't care. And so is the whiskey named after the Rebel Yell of the action? Maybe, but the song comes from the whiskey, and I don't even know that Billy Idol knew that the Rebel Yell was a Confederate thing. So I think I got to think – I'm saying I win that one. That's what I'm saying. Adam, can we get a ruling?
Well, I mean – I'll give you that one. I'm going to give Neil the other two. So, if we're just adding things up here, Neil still wins.
There you got it. This is from Jeff, and we're getting a take. Oh man, Jeff is coming off pissed off, and he may have a point. This is more than Adam White's tip. Hey, hi. My name is Jeff. In reference to your last episode about Punk and Drublic Fest, you all need to jump on the bandwagon and put a little more effort into learning about that craft beer thing. For one, what's more punk and DIY than saying F you to big beer, Anheuser-Busch, and doing it for yourself? Yeah, the brewing process is scuzzy, dirty, labor-intensive, and takes forever, but that's what makes it special. That's why people go out of their way to support a family or brewers rather than a faceless corporation. I'm going to pause. I actually think Jeff makes a pretty good point in that you can argue that a small local brewery is more punk rock than PBR or whatever. And then he says, another reason to get on board is the amount of press bands are putting in. You mentioned Iron Maiden has a beer, but there are many other bands that are working with local brewers to produce something unique. Deftones, Sublime, MXPX, Bayside, Descendants, and the list goes on. Educate yourselves. Stop buying big beer and support your local brewery. From Jeff.
Did we not make that point? Did we make the opposite point?
I don't remember. I just made fun of the craft beer concept. But I do agree with Jeff that you can make an argument. Actually, I think it's a pretty easy argument to make that.
I'm totally on board with whatever Jeff is arguing here. I'm surprised if whatever I was saying on the last one came off as not that. So, Jeff, if I was not advocating for small beer, I apologize. That's sort of how I live my life up here. There's small beer everywhere. And that's what that's what we prefer to patron up here. So yeah, I'm surprised that I would have made the opposite point. I guess, you know, if you want the local shout outs from my area. So, I live in Niagara. We have, I guess like everywhere in North America right now, like breweries cropping up left and right all over the place. The ones in the area here that are the ones that have a little bit, they're a little bit more established now and that people seem to be really into. There's a place called Oast House, which is out in Virgil, Ontario. Actually, both these are in Virgil. There's a place called Oast House that's up here. They do like mainly farmhouse ales and like saisons and things like that, and they're really awesome. They basically do my canonical beer. Like, if I'm going to close my eyes and pretend someone's going to pour me a pint of something, I would really prefer it's a pint of the Oast House Barn Raiser than anything, I think. And there's another one up here that's right down the street from Oast called Silversmith that they do like a really cool black lager and lots of other fun stuff. And they're in an old church, so they're in a cool kind of like place. There's a place up here in our area called Brimstone Brewery. Brimstone is in Ridgeway, Ontario. Ridgeville, Ridgeway. Yeah, Fort Erie. If you know Fort Erie, they're out that area. I can never remember all the names of the little things. But anyways, they're also in an old church, and Brimstone has a punk rock pilsner, which is a beer that they brew that is that's pretty good. And it's like an unfiltered pilsner, so it's like all cloudy and cool looking, and it's really good. So anyways, yeah, I'm big on craft. I don't know how I said that opposite, but yeah, agree with this guy.
Adam White, Pistner, punk rock or not punk rock?
What? What are you asking?
Remember like Sweden or wherever they had beer brewed from wee wee?
Oh. I mean, is that punk rock? I'm going to sidestep the question and say neither. It's I think I would have a hard time drinking that, science aside. Like, I'm sure that like science could come out and say that like look, yes, we've brewed this by a field that we've fertilized with urine, but due to like you know, due to the nature of how, you know, all the chemistry in this actually works, there is no actual human urine particulates in this beer anymore. And that could be explained to me, and a guy in a lab coat could say that, but I don't know if I would be able to fully put that aside and just embrace it for what it is and not think that there is some amount of pee that is in there. I don't know, man. The Pistner thing is weird. Europe, why do you do things like that?
Well, wait till you see they come out with the Krapner. That's even worse. Somebody play a song. Watch this terrible taste out of our mouth.
Yeah, okay. All right, here, I will. So I think I may have played these guys on a previous episode, but I've been listening to the record a lot lately, and it's really fun. So let's just do it. We're going to talk a little bit about like the org core of all org core on this episode. So we may as well give you something that is in that vein. So Needles Pins are out of Vancouver, BC. They had a record that came out a few years ago that everyone really liked called Shamebirds that was, you know, that was really good. And Needles Pins have a little bit of that gruff org core style vocalist, a little bit of that, you know, like Ryan Young from Off With Your Heads, or, you know, a little bit of like Brendan Kelly from the Lawrence Arms, like, you know, this somewhere in that range of, you know, snotty graveliness that everyone seems to love. So they had a record that came out called Goodnight Tomorrow on Mint Records. It was out on just the end of June this year. I saw the band play in Ottawa not too long ago, and they were really good, and everyone was singing along and pumping their fists. And it had been a while since I had actually seen a band like that live, which is, I guess, a weird thing to say because I'm so associated with punk news, but most of the bands that I go see live at this point are like really noisy garage bands and things like that. So to actually go see someone that's going to play like melodic punk rock is rare. But anyways, Needles Pins did a really good job of it. And everything on their new record is fun. If you like the thing that John hates, all, you know, songs about whiskey and friendship and all that, there's tons of it here. So anyways, this is Needles Pins. The song is All the Same. It's from Goodnight Tomorrow that came on a Mint Records on June 30th.
Oh,
that was Needles and Pins, and let's continue, as Adam White said, the Org Court conversation. Jawbreaker reunited, I think it was about the 3rd or so of August. And so that was literally their first show in, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. They played about a 6 or 7 song set opening for Monsula. And they're actually going to be playing another show in Oakland on August 12th. Of course, this precedes the big, big Riot Fest show that's going to be happening fairly soon in – where's Riot Fest? Chicago? In Chicago. People seemed excited about this. Do you guys think this is a new era for Jawbreaker, or is this going to be a Misfits thing? Two shows and out.
I think that this is an era. And I mean, I say that only because I think that they've said as much in an interview. There was an interview with Brooklyn Vegan that was not too long ago that Blake Schwarzenbach did, and in it, and I don't know if I can parse out the quote. Yeah, here it is. Okay, so among the things that they talked about, and you should go read the full interview that they have over there. They asked about like the sellout question, right? Like, you know, are you guys getting back together just for the money, or is there some sort of artistic reason for what you're doing, right? Like that whole thing came up. And this is the quote from here. I'm just going to read it verbatim because I think it's telling. And this is Blake speaking here. He says, "If anyone is worried about Jawbreaker selling out in 2017, they're clearly not living in this world. Selling out is kind of endorsed now. There is a culture online that is so pro-success, which has really been my battle for the past 10 years. People get mad at me for not promoting myself better. Like, what the hell is Forgetters? Why don't you capitalize it? Why don't you capitalize on who you are?" You can see here he used capitalize twice there because Forgetters always spelt their name lowercase. Anyways, people seem really hurt or offended that I wasn't trying to do something bigger. It really made me retreat and do it even smaller in a lot of cases. I just don't understand that kind of philosophy." So that's what Blake said there. So, and I think, John, if I am incorrect, that almost parallels something that I think you've talked about before on this show, which is that there's this, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and you're not the one that brought this up, but there is this thing about punk rock that will like, we're self-sabotaging to some degree.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that we'll not do something because we're worried about how people, you know, are going to perceive it. You know, bands will go and they'll play a show for like $5 and then not even be able to afford to put gas in their van. And, you know, I guess they've got the goodwill of having put on a $5 show, but at the end of it, they're like super poor. Whereas, you know, in the metal world, they'll charge you $20 to go to a show. And, you know, no one's accusing anyone of any impropriety about it. And everyone seems to be having a good time, right? You've had that whole conversation on here before. And I almost feel that like a little bit of that's coming through with what Blake was saying in that quote where like, you know what, like in this day and age, you know, up is down, left is right. No one's asking about like, no one's trying to hold bands up to like the moral code that we did say in the 90s. And now it's just like, hey, if you can go be an artist of any stripe at this point and make, you know, any money doing it, then I don't think anyone's going to begrudge you. And I guess that's what he's saying. And that's what he's struggling with is that reality. So I guess like given that quote, that sort of means that they're backpack.
Well, I mean, I'm just curious, like let's say they weren't doing it for the art and they just were doing it for the to quote unquote sell out. I gotta tell you, I don't think people nowadays, I mean, I never hear people say, you know, yell, you know, bands say to bands like you fucking sell out. You never see comments about that anymore. If anything, people get, you know, bands get congratulated for signing to, you know, bigger labels nowadays.
Yeah. I want to say it's less that like, you know, no one's going to go slash your tires like against me or anything, right? Like it's
yeah, I mean, that happened,
against me in some ways were like the last hurrah of people getting mad about that. But
yeah,
but I think it's more that if what you're doing is perceived as being for the money, then really quickly sort of like the shine will come off of what you're doing and you being around won't be all that special anymore. And like, so like the one that I'm thinking of there is Pixies. were like, you know, like, the, so when they reunited, it was a big deal. And it was a big deal for me, at least. Like, I bought tickets to go to Toronto to go to this big fucking aircraft hangar of a stadium thing so that I could go watch Pixies play, because
I didn't know you were a Pixies fan, Adam.
I went through that I think phase that people our age, John, do, where you're going through the 80s and you're trying to like dig up everything that was actually cool about you know, music in the 80s, and you get into your
Flock of Seagulls, yeah, Modern English.
More realistically, like Husker Du and the Replacements and things like that, right? And Pixies were like on that list for me, and I listened to like a ton of like of Surfer Rosa and Bossa Nova and Doolittle and all everything, and so getting to go see the Pixies and see them play, you know, I want to see them play both versions of Wave of Mutilation, right? Like I want to go see them play the hits because, you know, they're not going to be doing this too long. It's a once in a lifetime thing. They're getting back together, but the fucking Pixies have just kept touring. Like there's going to be like they're going to play my local grocery store or something soon. Like I just feel like they're everywhere. And they're releasing stuff, and the stuff they're releasing, no one really seems to care all that much about. And it's just, I mean, I don't begrudge them wanting to still make music together under that name or anything, but the whatever made it special has evaporated at this point. They're just a band, right?
And will Jawbreaker get to that point?
I guess that's the question, right? So like, I don't think that you sell out in with all this like fury and shouting and fan confrontation anymore. I think like that the sellout these days is a little bit more insidious, where you just sort of like become fat and boring. I wasn't meant to be like a Frank Black joke.
Adam, why with the body shame?
Not body shame. No.
Let me tell you people that listen to podcasts. I was speaking to Adam White on the Facebook Messenger, and I said to Adam White, "Don't worry, I won't body shame you." And Adam White responds by body shaming me. And that's something Adam White's got to get under control, people, let me tell you.
Oh, so yeah, that's the risk, right? The risk is that Jawbreaker sticks around, and then it's, you know, everyone forgets why they were so revered in the first place, and then they're just a band that's releasing like EPs that no one gives a shit about, which is what happened to the Pixies.
Not to draw this out, but if Jawbreaker does new material, can they ever live up to fan expectations?
I don't know. I mean, has that happened before where it's been successful? I'm trying to think of an example of.
Neurosis,
I want to say like
Amoebics.
The Falcon. I mean,
Falcon. I mean, like the Falcon didn't disappear like the amount of time that they would need to there, and I feel that like the people that loved like a lot of people loved the Falcon back in the. What was that fucking record called? Like whatever 5,000
unicorn. It was Unicornography.
Yeah. What was the? Didn't they have like an EP before that?
They did. I forgot what it's called though.
But the people that like loved like the Unicornography stuff, they stuck with the whole Lawrence Arms family of music coming out up until then, or like between the two. So like I don't think that you had the. You didn't have that absence that everyone was just sort of like yearning for stuff there. Like if you wanted your Brendan Kelly fix, there were avenues to get that. And like on the one hand, like yeah, like Schwarzenbach was doing stuff, but again, like he said it himself in that quote, like it was so low key at times that it just didn't click with people. So I'm struggling to think of a band that has been. That had like their kind of reverence and then disappeared and did a comeback and it was successful. And like any of the examples I have in my head don't work. Like they're in no way near the same category. Like you can't use Bad Religion as an example because they never stopped releasing records. Right. So despite the fact that they had this like late career resurgence thing doesn't count. I kind of want to say Buzzcocks, but again, they never really stopped releasing records. They just, you know, they took a little break and then they released one that a lot more people cared about than the ones prior. But
I do have a question, though. I mean, let's say the, and I'm kind of surprised that this hasn't happened yet, but let's say the, I mean, it, I don't even know if it would work if the original Misfits got back together to do an album.
I don't know. Like on one hand, like to me, like Misfits are in like a totally different tier than Jawbreaker. Like I get that
higher or lower,
higher, right?
Oh like, yeah. Okay. Good.
Jawbreaker has like reverence of the people that were like around and teenagers during that kind of 90s scene. Right. But they're on the same sort of tier to me as like Kid Dynamite and Lifetime were of those style of bands that were very influential, but their cultural impact was within a scene. Their cultural impact didn't go outside of the scene. And Refused, I think, is a probably a good example for like what could happen, right?
Yeah.
So Refused.
Exactly. That's a good one.
Yeah, exactly. That's good. Good job, Adam. That's a good example. Yeah. No, but yes, please applaud. Refused, I think, is the perfect example of what could go wrong, right?
Yeah.
Because Refused, exactly. Shape of Punk to Come, like groundbreaking. Everyone's blown away by it. Everyone's talking about it. And then they go away and they disappear, right? It's a singular artistic statement and then they're gone. And their other stuff, if you were into it, their other stuff is different enough that a different era of that band could mean a lot to you, and Shape of Punk would have been something totally different. I think maybe in the same way that you could be totally into Dear You and or totally into 24 Hour Revenge Therapy or what's the cat one? Unfun? Anyone? Jawbreaker album, cat on the cover.
I am not familiar with their catalog. I'm starting them when I see the documentary.
Hold on. It's Unfun. I'm just going to make sure I'm not wrong about this. It's Unfun. Yeah. So anyways, if you were a particular fan of any of those records, and those records are different enough from each other in sound, it's probably not dissimilar to you being a huge fan of Shape of Punk to Come or a huge fan of like Songs to Fan the Flames of Discontent, the Refused album that came up before that. And then they're gone for a while. And if you were a huge fan of Refused, the stuff that came out after that, I could see it not really registering for you. Dennis was fairly visible with International Noise Conspiracy. I mean, like they were signed to Epitaph for a while, but you know, if you were really into them doing like gonzo ambient metal punk weirdness, then, you know, hearing him play like 60s garage rock is not going to be your thing. So I could totally see how if you were a mega Refused fan, you ignored Noise Conspiracy. And what else would you have had to gone to at that point? Like Text? Like that was that band that the other guys went and formed that was just weirdness.
Then there's that hardcore band they had.
What was the hardcore band?
It was like A4N or something like that, or AC4.
I don't remember at all, but that all of those things sound familiar. But yes, there was enough absence. There was enough stuff that you weren't necessarily going to latch onto because it wasn't super well promoted or wasn't incredibly in the same genre or anything like that. It probably pretty much parallels what Blake was doing with Forgetters or what was the other band that he had?
I don't know
that other thing.
Guy plays mid-tempo garage song. I mean, mid-tempo guitar song and.
I'm skipping over I'm skipping over Just to Brazil entirely in this conversation because they had a fair amount of following, but the by the time Just to Brazil stopped doing stuff, I'm likening that era. So between like the end of Just to Brazil, so after Perfecting Loneliness came out until now, I'm comparing that to like the after Shape of Punk to Come. Until whenever Refused came back. But then Refused came back and everyone got really super excited about it and all charged up. And then what did they release? Like a record that people talked about for 12 minutes and none of it fawning. Like,
I don't remember. Yeah, I remember it being like very okay.
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember it at all. And I actually, and to me, like the biggest problem was that, like, I'm not actually making a critical judgment on the record because I don't know if I've heard it. Like, I heard a song from it or something out of curiosity when they were doing the initial press for it. And I just had this sort of like, yeah, you know, like, oh, okay. All right. Refuses making stuff again. And I don't understand how I had that reaction to it, because like when I first, I think I first encountered Shape of Punk to Come with the New Noise video. And like, if you're coming into that cold, and you hit and you see like the New Noise video for the first time, like that video is fucking intense. Like that song is just, you know, if you're listening to like, I don't know, like if you listen to Pennywise and the Bouncing Souls and everything like that, and then you come across the Refused New Noise video on your comp of Epitaph music videos that you're doing, like it's like it's from the moon. Like it is totally shockingly different. And to compare that reaction to like the nothing reaction, like the reaction I can barely remember for the new Refused stuff, it makes me sad, right? So like that's the risk, is that Jawbreaker comes back and they do something and it's just like a big wet thud and no one gives a shit. And
well yeah. Oh, go ahead, Adam, sorry.
I just like, well, because then that seeps backwards, right? So then, you know, you have the level of reverence that you do now, because a little bit of this like absence makes the heart grow fonder thing, right? You know, have there been punk songs as good as, you know, Boxcar and Ashtray Monument and everything? Yeah, of course, right? Tons every year since those records have come out. But those records came out and then there was nothing from that band, and people loved them and listened to them on repeat, and, you know, and wished, oh, I wish I could have seen that band more when it was around, right? And told their friends about them, and it became like a private little thing that like that they really liked and that their friends really liked, and that, you know, it was a bonding thing for them. And like, there's a reason why this stuff, you know, grows in popularity over time when a band goes away. The same thing happened with like the Kid Dynamite records that everyone was super into. Like, there, I feel like I hear like six bands a year that sound exactly like Kid Dynamite sounds, and all of them sound fine to me. Like that they're fine bands. They're okay. And if Kid Dynamite was to show up out of context and, you know, rename the record and give me that today, I'm sure I would just go like, yeah, all right. Like that's fine. I'm okay with that. And then you go on. Like, would there, if they dropped a Kid Dynamite record on you right now, and it sounded like whichever one of their records you want to pick, and then you were to go and hold that up against, like, I don't know, like the new Brutal Youth record, are those two things going to seem all that dissimilar to you? Like, probably not. And they'll both seem fine, but not one of them isn't all of a sudden going to become like this fetish object in your life. But the reason
wait. The Brutal Youth album that came out last year was phenomenal.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it was phenomenal, but there aren't going to be people sitting around in 20 years, you know, fawning about it in the way that they did about the Kid Dynamite thing, only because Kid Dynamite had like the opportunity of being like early, and then they disappeared. And then when they disappeared, everyone sat there and sort of like ground on it for so long that it became like a religion. Right. Brutal Youth, as good as that record is, as good as that band is, that's never going to happen to them because, like, A, timing, but B, they're still out there being a band, and there's other bands that kind of sound like that too. So then they're just sort of like another good melodic hardcore band. Right. So there's a lot of like weird voodoo that goes into what makes one of these things like a cultural touchstone within a scene. And I think like the danger with Jawbreaker is that they're going to go and release something. And if it is like any of their past records, not sound like the prior records, because their records don't sound like each other. Like, they don't sound like each other on fundamental levels. Like, the recording quality is totally all over the place compared to them. The style of songwriting is all over the place compared to them. You know, people when Jawbreaker was around, people would hate their records when they came out because they were in love with the way that the prior record sounded. If you were really in love with 24 Hour Revenge Therapy, you did not like Dear You. And people did not like Dear You when it came out. But people kind of like grew to appreciate it and love it in that absence, right? So, you know, first of all, they're going to come out with something. It's going to not sound like either of those records. It's going to sound like whatever the band makes today. And that's going to drive people bananas. And then the fact that it's something that they came out with today, it's not going to have those years of, you know, seeping into people's subconscious that creates these sort of like long-term punk rock Stockholm syndromes that we have with some of these bands. So, you know, it's at best, people are going to be like, all right, it was fine. And then they're going to move on. It's going to be like any of the new Descendants records, where as good as they are, people are going to go, yeah, all right, they're fine. And then their attention is going to drift and then they're going to move on to something else. And I like all of the modern day Descendants records. I own them. I'm not just dissing that. But that's the thing, is like no one's gonna go hold up Hypercavenum Spazinate as the canonical Descendants record one day. It's just going to be like another Descendants record. Like there's nothing that they will be able to do that is going to unseat something like Milo Goes to College in the consciousness of the scene.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't know. I'm just rambling because it feels good.
I cut this story and actually let's bring it up. There are two counterattacks to the fundamental point you're making. We can talk about this a little bit, Motorhead recently is releasing a covers compilation, and one of the unreleased tracks is a cover of David Bowie's Heroes. And there's two counterattacks to Adam's point, and maybe this is congruent with Adam's point. Adam's point is these bands defined an era, then disappeared, and people, you know, grew fond of them because they were gone. But Motorhead, you came out of the gate, kicked ass, and just kept kicking ass for 30 years until Lemmy Kilmister died. You know, the other counterattack is Adam White talked about how if a band that has reunited is trapped, in that if they release a different sounding album, people will be mad because it doesn't sound like the one before it. But if they release an album that sounds like the one before, people are mad because it's not as mind bending as the previous one. Counterattack, David Bowie covered by Motorhead. David Bowie made a career out of coming out with wildly different sounds and people loving it when it was released.
Well, okay, David Bowie was a fucking wizard, so he doesn't factor into of these punk rock bands, okay? Like, I think there's a measurable difference between, Bowie is one of these, like, singular features, this is going to be the most on-the-nose thing I've ever said. Bowie was a spaceman that came to Earth, John. Like, he was not a normal kind of musician, and I don't think that necessarily you can equate too much from his career and experience to anyone else. Now, the Motorhead thing is interesting, though, because people liked Motorhead, and Motorhead never went away, but was there much of a, you know, when Motorhead releases their, here, I'm going to actually pull a real one here, so it's not just something I'm pulling out of my butt here. Let's see. Motorhead discography. How many things are in the Motorhead discography, John?
How many albums?
How many full lengths proper?
17.
17. Okay. So releases Kiss of Death in 2006, does that make, outside of you being a Motorhead fan, or a fan of that style of metal or whatever, does that make much of a blip in the scene, people are of course aware of it, but it doesn't become a pillar, right? And I think that's what I'm saying, like, you know, the next album the Descendants release, people are going to be into it, it'll be fine, people will like it, that's great, but it's not going to be Milo Goes to College. And it's not because, and Milo Goes to College isn't that good. It's just more that, like, it's important.
Oh, I disagree. Right? I think Milo.
No, I think it's a very good record.
Okay, shut up.
I
think Milo Goes. What I mean is that
it's, fuck you.
It's important. More than anything on there is.
We're going to get letters for that.
Yeah. Well, but that's what I mean, though. Like, it's an importance thing more than it is, say, like a quality thing, right? Like,
I disagree, Adam. I think Miley Goes to College is phenomenal all the way through.
Miley Goes to College is great, but I don't think there's necessarily a gigantic dip in quality between that and other stuff that the Descendants have done. Well, I mean, there's been dips that the Descendants have done, but there's... But it's not like they peaked and had their one moment of brilliance and everything else has been riding on those coattails. What I'm saying is that it was important because it was culturally important. And that's partly why everyone has so much affection for it. And as many things as they release post that are good, it's not going to have the same. It's not going to supplant that thing that has the cultural impact. That thing that has, like, become one of the pillars of the genre, whatever you want to say. So I'm just saying that's the risk. Is like it's sort of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing with Jawbreaker. Because I mean, if they're going to be true to what they've done, then the next thing that they release shouldn't rightfully sound like anything that they've done. And if it does sound like just a rehash of the stuff that they did, then they're really going to quickly veer into the territory of, you know, of again, bands I like. I'm that sounds like I'm slagging bands I like, but like a band like Bad Religion, where, you know, I'm a huge Bad Religion fan. Is there a gigantic difference between one Bad Religion record and the other? Not really. I mean, I don't really care, but at the same point, I'm not going to go and get in a giant argument about someone about how, like, I don't know, like New Maps of Hell is the, you know, should be held up in the pantheon of the top three punk records ever. Like, I'm not going to make those arguments despite the fact that I enjoyed that record. And I think it's going to be that sort of thing if they just go back and they're like, all right, people really liked this Dear You stuff over the years. Let's do more of those. Let's crank out some Dear You's. Like, if they do that, then
is Jawbreaker Canadian in this example?
That was me to be like, I was trying to come up with like a New York construction accent there.
Something is Jawbreaker, like, from New York?
I don't know. That was just the accent that I would. Something about Dear You's, like pluralizing the You's, made me want to do that. I don't know. Am I making any point here, or am I just talking?
I think you've made many salient points, Adam, and I think, much like the Bible, it's open to interpretation and reflection and introspection.
And people should kill in my name.
That's right. Tricky Ricky, speaking of people killing in Adam's name, why don't you play a song?
All right. Let me find where I put it. Hang on a second. Okay. A friend of mine told me about this band. They're called CHEW, Chew, I guess. But they abbreviated it. It's an acronym. Let me find it here. So, they're cool. They have like a hardcore D beat kind of thing. They're out of Chicago. They put out a split EP, called the Penetrode Split. And they got some cool like four songs on there. You can check it out on their Bandcamp. So the song I'm going to play from that is called Voluntary Human Extinction, to really lighten up the mood. And so here is Voluntary Human Extinction by Chew.
Bye.
And so, listen, we spent a lot of time on Jawbreaker. We got some more stories. We're going to blast through them. This one's pretty interesting. Peter of the Test Tube Babies was flying to the United States for Punk Invasion 2017. He got to the States. I think he was in San Francisco, but I'm not sure about that. He got to the airport, and then he was stopped by Border Control right there. Then he was taken into a room, and they flipped the computer around and said, "Is this you?" And on the computer screen was a picture of Peter of the Test Tube Babies as Donald Trump, making fun of Donald Trump, obviously. Peter Bywaters says he was not allowed in the United States because he was making fun of Donald Trump. Borders Control, they released a statement, and they said the claim that Peter was refused to enter the United States because he mocked the president of the United States, this is absolutely not true. This is false. The reason he was denied entry was because he came with the wrong visa. Who knows? I wish we were able to get to the bottom of this. I wish we could see what visa he had and compare and contrast. But we've got a he said, she said scenario. And one of the main things this brings up is I don't know if Adam White has this issue in Canada, but a lot of people implementing laws in the United States don't know what the laws are that they're implementing. You know what I mean? Like border control guys or even cops, they'll like – think they have the right to do things and they don't have the right to do things, or they'll just start shit just because they feel as if they can when really they don't have the right to do so. One of the best examples I have is one time I got pulled over by the cops. Welcome to John getting pulled over by the police stories. They said, show us your proof of insurance. Well, I had an insurance card, but it was outdated, but I did have insurance. So I said, well, I can pull up on my phone because I got insurance. And he said, that's not good enough. So he gave me a ticket. And so that, which is not true, you don't actually have to have written proof of insurance. You just have to have proof of insurance. So the cop didn't know the law. However, in Pennsylvania, if you do have insurance and you don't have it on you when you get pulled over, you can go to the police station, show it to the cop, and they're supposed to withdraw the ticket. So I go down to the police station with the written proof of insurance. I show it to them. They never heard of this thing ever, even though they're supposed to be implementing the laws. They never heard of this ever. So I had to go to trial, and I, of course, won a trial, which is what I do. But it was a big waste of my time. And the point being that a lot of people implementing laws don't know what the hell they're doing. So it seemed to me like if he had the wrong visa, why is this border control agent asking Peter Bywaters about his Donald Trump thing? And you're allowed to do that anyways. The point and the answer is, did he not have the right visa? I don't know. I wish I knew. But there's really no reason for the border controller to be asking about that unless he thinks he's a danger, which obviously he's not a danger, which just goes to show people implementing laws usually have no idea of the actual laws that they're implementing and abuse that process. And I don't know if there's a solution for that. Maybe that's just the nature of a government of itself, that as the further you trickle down and maybe even at the top, there's going to be people abusing laws and implementing laws. They don't know what they're implementing. And I don't know if there's a solution for that or not.
You know, I'm with you on this, John. It's hard to know really kind of what happened here. I think the BBC article that broke this was terribly written and really did not get to the bottom of it. So it's hard to tell. I if it's for mocking Trump, I just don't buy that because that happens.
I do.
I don't. I think that happens all the time. I don't think. I highly doubt that was the reason. I believe that maybe a visa was wrong, but at the same time, we don't know. But I think this whole.
Why are they asking about the Trump video then if it's the wrong visa? If it's the wrong visa.
I'm glad you asked that no. Because I'm not a immigration person here at all, but I think you need a certain visa to perform here and work. So
true.
I think that's why they asked him. I think the mere fact that he was mocking Trump, I don't think they care. I think that might have been the issue. Maybe they said, "Oh, he has the wrong." Here's like a totally a scenario. Okay, just this isn't what happened, but let's say they got the wrong visa, like it's a travel visa, and they end up playing shows, and then they get caught for playing shows, even though they're on a travel visa instead of a work visa. I I don't think that's far-fetched. And again, I don't know what happened, but I feel like that's fairly reasonable to kind of ask, right?
But then why show the Trump video as opposed to any of the 999,000 pedo test tube babies videos there are?
Was the wasn't the video of him performing like when they got there?
No. He never got to perform.
Oh, well,
this was like at the airport turned around. Like he didn't get to the US.
Maybe it was they got the wrong visa and they said, oh, this guy is probably going to perform. And instead got the wrong visa. And that was really just for travel. I mean, I think that's
why should the Trump video as opposed to any other videos of him performing?
It was probably one of the most recent ones. I mean, again, I'm just asking questions. I don't know. But to say that for mocking Trump, I don't believe that too much because listen, Comedy Central is basically Trump bashing network at this point. That's what they do. Trevor Noah, Daniel Tosh. There's literally a show dedicated to making fun of the president. I highly doubt that that was the reason. This could have been just like immigration being dicks. I don't know. Bureaucracy like this can screw up all the time. And guess what? The people working there don't care about your life. So I think this could have been more of a mix up than preventing him from coming in because he mocked our president. I want to see proof of that.
You touched on what I'm thinking the situation was. And actually you brought up a good point. Now it's entirely possible that what got you into the room with the guy with the laptop is that some piece of paperwork wasn't straight in the first place. So
right.
Let's say they did come in with an expired visa or something with the paperwork wasn't right in the visa or whatever, right? Or who knows what is going to actually get you in the room with the border guy that's going to be more of a dick than the other border guy. It could be because you were being obnoxious in the line at the airport and then they pulled you aside. Now, what you touched on what I think is the kind of the point here is and we've actually in my day job, we have gone and looked into this numerous times. And this always ends up being the answer for it is you could have every piece of paperwork that you need to cross the border into the United States completely, you know, every I dotted, every T crossed, everything is ironclad. And it doesn't matter. Because if the guy at the border gets his nose at a joint for some reason that you're talking to, he has full discretion to make your life hell and turn you away or whatever else. There's no way that you can say like, no, like I have the paperwork. Like it doesn't matter. The guy can do it if he's going to be a dick, if he's going to get his nose at a joint or anything like that. So
also if he's going to be a dick, just real quick. If he's going to be a dick, he can be like, oh, who's this guy? Google him and he finds a video of this.
Well, right. And that's exactly it. So we see this from bands all the time that when they're trying to say cross the border to go play a tour and they don't have the horrible requirements that they need done for that, you know, for over 10 years, bands have emailed me and been like, oh, can you take our tour dates off of Punk News? Because we're about to cross the border. I've been asked that more times than I have fingers on which to count. And you know, you always want to just stop and go like, really? Like that, like, is that going to help you? It's going to be in the Google cache or something. And they're just like, you know what? We're just playing it safe. Whatever we can do to not cause us a problem is what we're trying to do, right? And again, it's not that when you pull up to the border, they're going to go sit there and Google you at the moment where they're sitting there checking your passport or whatever. It's at the point where they've already decided for some reason that you know, like I don't like this van full of assholes, and then they pull you over, and then someone sits down at a computer and starts punching in stuff to what you're doing. And then, you know, hey, if you have tour dates on Punk News and you say, oh, we're just going over to record, then they're going to be like, well, why does it say here on a website that you're going to play a tour in the city that's across the border that you're trying to cross, right? Like that happens. And so like, for the reason why this comes up in my day job is that like we do work on both sides of the border here, the Niagara Falls, Ontario, and Niagara Falls, New York. And, you know, we have clients on both sides, and we employ people at our company that are dual citizens. So they can go over as they want, and it's not a problem for them to go into the States. But we've been like, you know what, it would be great if we could take some of the talent that we have in house that has, like, you know, that knows more about X and send them over to help with that job. So what do we have to do? Is there some sort of visa that we can get for them? Is it, you know, we looked into, I mean, before all the, like, all these, like, H-1B visa things have been in the news a lot because Trump's been, you know, railing against them. But, you know, we looked into all those visas and everything. And it's like, you know, is there something that we can pay for that would get our guy, when he's going over there to do work for a client, you know, allow him through? He's clearly not there to, you know, blow up a dam. He's there to fix a computer at someone's office, and that's what he's there to do. You know, is there anything we can do? And we talked to immigration lawyers and everything. And the answer always comes down to, you know, sure, you can pay for all this paperwork. You can get all these visas and things lined up. You can, you know, you can dance the dance of a thousand veils perfectly. But if you get to the border and the guy doesn't like the look on your face, he can fuck you up and turn you away. And all that shit that you've had done is for naught. And that's the one thing that's nice for us is that because we have people that carry an American passport, sometimes they'll get the guy being dick, and then they do this very American thing that I assume, which is they pull out their American passport and they're like, I'm an American, so fuck you. And then the border guard is like, you know, Godspeed, sir. That's the American way. And then they let him through. Right. But, you know, me or the other Canadians, we can't do that. So, yeah, it's dicey. You could have everything right, and the guy's going to be a jerk. And that is partly the problem with the whole, like, Trump atmosphere, is that if you are going to be like a mouth breathing, you know, rah, 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 America first border guard, then, you know, you are empowered now to be a super dick because you have, like, super dick number one with his finger on the trigger telling you to do it. So it's made none of the laws necessarily have changed all that much with regards to, I think, border crossing into the States, like travel bans and things like that aside. But the atmosphere around it and, like, the leeway that you have is way different than it was. That said, I'm going to Philly this weekend to see John.
Yeah,
nothing bad is going to happen.
Godspeed, Adam. And if the border guards stop you, don't just tell them you know me. Tell them you know me. Listen, we're running late. We got three stories. Which of these do you guys want to cover?
I can make the bomb pops one fast if you want.
Go ahead, hit it.
All right, so Alternative Press premiered the bomb pops video for their song "Be Sweet." The track is from their album "Fear of Missing Out," which I thought was quite good. That came out earlier this year on Fat Records. You can watch the video on the Punk News article. So the only thing I'm going to say about this, the video is fine. They kind of did like this Ed Sullivan kind of play. Just two things about it. The guy that's sort of playing the talk show host, that's actually Polly Van Damme's husband, who is in Murderland. And you should check out their album too. They're really cool. And he has really good stage presence. But anyway, the other thing is the thing that's really important about this song in particular from the album is that it was written by Brandon Carlisle of Teenage Bottle Rocket, and he let them, you know, he gave it to them to record before he passed away. So check it out. Check out this album if you haven't. They're good people, and they're from my neck of the woods. So yeah, check out the video.
Cool.
All right. Let's see. I guess let's. Do we want to talk about Kid Creole, or is it too depressing? I'll mention it quickly. This is a very depressing story. Kid Creole, one of it's hard to overstate the importance of Kid Creole in hip hop. He's one of the main members of Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. He's on all those early hit singles: "Happy Birthday," "White Lines," "Don't Do It," "Message Part 2." He's on all those tracks. He was walking down the street sometime last week, and a homeless guy. No one's exactly sure what happened, but it seemed as though the homeless guy basically either yelled at Kid Creole and called him the F word as in a slur, negative word for gay people, or he came on to him. So allegedly, Kid Creole kind of freaked out, pulled out a knife, and stabbed the guy to death. And so now Kid Creole's in jail, and it's definitely not looking too good for him. They allegedly have him on camera doing the deed. What complicates this further is the homeless guy that got stabbed to death. He wasn't necessarily a nice guy either. He did some time for some pretty bad domestic abuse. I don't know if there's anything you can glean from this whatsoever. It just seemed to be a bad situation. I feel sorry for Kid Creole because he is a seminal figure in hip hop. And basically was just working a lot of people have to work a regular 9-to-5 job. So I guess I don't feel bad for him about that. But I feel bad that I guess he made a very bad decision. I don't know if he was a violent guy to begin with. All his neighbors said that he was a nice guy and everyone liked him. So I think maybe he just kind of lost his head and for a few minutes. And that really is going to ruin the rest of his life, apparently. And so I don't know if there's anything you can take from this. I don't know if there's any advice from this.
Don't kill homeless people.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyone, really.
Yeah, I think murder's probably not a good thing.
I guess the thing is when did you get upset? Step back and think about the situation. Somebody, I don't know who said this, but somebody said when someone cuts you off in traffic, you know, you can yell at them, you can get in a fight with them or whatever, or you can just let them go and they're out of your life forever, you know. And I don't agree with that 100%. I do think there are times in your life where you do have to stick up for yourself. But most of the time, I do agree with that, is just let them go and they're out of your life forever. You know what
just
I mean?
Choose your battles. Shit, this was not necessary at all.
Yeah, I feel bad. I guess I feel bad for everybody involved, you know. It's just a bad scenario, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't kill people. All right, John, you got a final song to leaven the mood here?
Yeah. Let's play something happy. Let's play Billy Idol song. Man, everybody loves Billy Idol. Billy Idol is great. I think he doesn't quite get – I mean, he's famous and has made a lot of money, but I don't know if he gets quite enough respect in the punk rock community that he should. Oh, and I'll play Generation X song, Billy Idol's band before he was Billy Idol. Let's play, let's see here. I know Ready, Steady, Go, which is one of my favorite Generation X songs. This is Billy Idol basically singing about how much he loves rock and roll in his band Generation X, Billy Idol and Generation X doing Ready, Steady, Go.
I'm not in love with the radio. I'm not in love with the radio.
And we're back, and that was Billy Idol. I hope everyone's in a better mood now. Billy Idol is cool. Tricky Ricky, do you agree? Billy Idol, is he cool?
I'm still he's on my list of bands to see live. He's been in Vegas doing like his Billy Idol Forever thing for like this year, and he hasn't been out here lately. So I still want to see him.
Adam White, Billy Idol, cool or not cool?
I mean, he got his face on those fireworks, right?
That's right. let's cut it right there.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@valorundergroundstudios.com.